We will go forward then, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the case of In the Matter of the Welfare of the Child of SAK, A20-1489. You'll each have 15 minutes to present your arguments with 5 minutes for appellant on rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please state your names at the beginning of your argument because these are being recorded. Thank you. And with that, Ms. Wimmer.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Kimberly Wimmer, and I represent the appellant, the mother in this matter, SAK. In addition to the arguments that I've laid out in the appellant's brief, I have this additional argument to present to you here today. It is the appellant's position that the trial court record does not support the determination that grounds exist to terminate the mother's parental rights. The court can find an order termination of parental rights when at least one statutory ground for termination is supported by clear and convincing evidence, and termination is in the best interest of the child, provided that the county has made reasonable efforts to reunify the family. In this case, there are issues in all of these areas. In addition, there are procedural and due process concerns with the trial process itself. Turning first to the statutory grounds, the district court found that three statutory grounds were present to support a termination of parental rights by clear and convincing evidence. First, 260C.301 subdivision 1 clause B2. I won't read the entire thing, but essentially provides that a termination may be appropriate if the parent substantially, continuously, or repeatedly neglected to comply with the duties of the parent-child relationship, including failing to provide food, clothing, shelter, education, or other required care. It is my position here today that just wasn't part of the record, that wasn't part of the evidence, that the what was presented does not establish this by clear and convincing evidence. To the contrary, there was evidence provided that the mother in this matter did provide not only those basic cares, food, clothing, shelter, but also that she went above and beyond and provided additional things such as taking the child to the library, participating in crafts, doing art projects, enrolling the child in preschool, finding a mental health program that she felt was most appropriate for the child. There was evidence presented that the mother took steps to make sure the child always had proper food, people who saw her out in the community, whether they be friends or just people who were familiar with mother, always said that the child was well taken care of. And perhaps most important, in my opinion, there was evidence presented, or evidence that's part of the record, from St. Louis County, which was a neighboring county providing courtesy supervision in this matter, that also indicated that county felt that the child was being well taken care of, that there weren't issues, that there was repeated visits to the home and encounters with mother and child in that particular county, who was hands-on day-to-day immediately prior to this the termination of parental rights petition being filed, did not have concerns. Ms. Wimmer,
can I just clarify your client's position? That it sounds like your client believes the many of the findings the court made are erroneous because the record does not support those. That's my preliminary question. Then I have a follow-up. Is that a fair summary of the overall arching position of your client?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it seems that the district court focused on the DBT. It was a big issue, and it seemed like it was an issue that was raised in the earlier TPR, and a big focus of that court, who was satisfied that she had started taking part in some of the services and really focused on the mental health related issues. This court has made findings. It appears that she has not been taking part in the DBT. I guess my question is this: the judge seemed to focus on the results of whatever perhaps parts of the case plan your client did comply with. For instance, there was an arms worker. She did see Dr. Dwayne Dale, I believe it is, or therapist, I should say, a counselor. But the court made specific findings, and I did see that in the transcript too, that he's not a DP, DBT therapist. My point being is, what evidence in the record would your client then point us to that her compliance with some of these provisions has resulted in changes in a positive way? In other words, that seems like the focus of our case law, that even if one technically complies with a case plan, conditions have changed such that what led to the out-of-home placement has changed such the child now can safely go back into the home. Is there something in the record you would point us to, whether it's related to DBT or ARMS, that shows a positive change in her mental health overall such that the child should return home?
Sure. Your Honor, I would point first to the testimony of Dwayne Dale. He did, you know, provide testimony as far as how he felt that the mother was complying. I understand that there was cross-examination and even examination from the court itself with respect to Mr. Dale, but he did provide evidence about positive strides he felt that SAK was making.
I would agree that the district court seemed to not give much weight to Mr. Dale's testimony because he didn't corroborate any of it. He just relied on what mother said. That was my reading of the order.
That is my reading as well. I guess I would make the argument that, you know, Mr. Dale is in a position to know much better how those sessions were going and what was being accomplished in those sessions, and whether he had outside collateral contacts or not, he was seeing progress in SAK, which is ultimately what everybody's wanting to see.
But you would agree that we don't reweigh the witness testimony. We rely on the district court to make credibility determinations.
I do agree with that. Yes, Your Honor. Back to the judge's original question, I'd also point to the testimony of SAK herself, explaining how she felt that she had improved. I would point just to the procedural history in this matter and the history that led to this matter.
But you could see where the district court was maybe a little suspicious of her testimony because she continued to have encounters with the police that led to charges during the time of this, during this, I'll call it the second TPR, during that time.
I could see where the court would definitely weigh that. I think there were also positive things that she testified to that the court could weigh as well, as far as insight into how different things benefited her, you know, how she felt that she had changed. Other testimony, I think, that supports that SAK was benefiting or doing better would have been the evidence, the trial exhibits that were presented with information from St. Louis County. I think that was important evidence in this matter. As far as a different view from the people who were providing day-to-day supervision, as far as how they felt things were going, and it was different from how the agency in this matter, Coochin County, felt things were going. I discussed one statutory criteria, turning now to 260C.301 subdivision 1 clause B4, the palpable unfitness. And I would agree
that,
with some.
Can I just follow up? I'm sorry, I just wanted to follow up before you transition a bit. The court made a finding, and this is follow up perhaps to some of your comments in number finding of fact 25. The judge wrote that perhaps in large part due to her personality profile as well as her mental illness since the inception of this proceeding, Ms. Knapp has refused to accept the recommendations of professionals. And so, and that seems to go also to his credibility finding as to the counselor, but a big picture, I think you mentioned that, for instance, the courtesy visits, I saw there was evidence in the record that and findings related to her not even wanting to have that courtesy provider share the information with Ms. Treat about the criminal behavior. But isn't that sort of a big picture finding the court used to reach its conclusions? And if your client believes that's erroneous, what would you point us to in particular that would allow us to say that a finding such as that, that she's not accepting the aid of the professionals, is erroneous?
I would say just that she is working with the, you know, at the time of the trial in this matter, she's working with the professionals that many who she had struggled to work with in the past. She was working with an arms worker. She was working with Mr. Dale. She was working and cooperating with St. Louis County. You know, there were a variety of professionals that she did have a positive relationship with and was cooperating with and, you know, getting their benefit from. So I think that is, to me, that's a big, an important piece to consider, that she was making progress and she was doing these things that was different from the first termination of parental rights matter, definitely.
And how does would you agree the judge, in considering all that and heard those same arguments, I suspect, from your client during her testimony and did, that you're making today and you made to the court, when you add the Facebook video comments, there seemed to be a pretty obvious disdain for all the professionals involved in the case. Would it not be appropriate for the court to consider that in reaching the finding that I just quoted to you? And we would defer, of course, to the judge with that sort of evidence.
Certainly. With respect to the Facebook video, I would take the stance that her disdain at the time was at the Coochin County social worker primarily, was where, you know, there's evidence throughout that they had a very conflicted relationship, that it wasn't a very good working relationship. I don't interpret that as being directed at the other individuals that I identified previously, meaning the therapist, arms worker, and those individuals who she was working cooperatively with at the time of this termination of parental rights trial. I can see I'm running out of time, so I'll just kind of hit more of my main points I wanted to hit. With respect to, you know, the court's addressed some of the criminal behavior that it was certainly a concern to the court and to others involved. And I would just make the argument that there was not evidence presented that any of that alleged behavior adversely impacted the child. The respondent does make a statement in the respondent's brief that the child was with SAK on those occasions, or I think the brief says many of those occasions, and I don't think that the evidence supports that. I think SAK provided testimony that some of her behavior that was considered troubling by the other parties, she didn't act that way when the child was with her. She had an explanation that she felt these encounters were in part because she was misunderstood, because others didn't understand her, but she didn't act that way when her child was with her. And I don't think there's evidence to support that the child was harmed.
Ms. Slimmer, would you address the best interests of the child and where you think the judge made erroneous findings?
Yes. I believe that it is in the best interest of the child that he be with his mother. I think that's in the child's best interest. That's in my client's best interest. In the competing interests that might weigh to that, permanency for the child, having consistent care, having his basic needs met. Those are all things that can be provided from my client. I think that there was testimony that was, I think all parties agreed that the mother and child in this case had a very loving bond. They had good interactions together. They had a very significant relationship, and my client also is able to meet those needs and provide those things, permanency and consistent care, and his basic needs as well. So I think when you consider all of that, it would be in the best interest that the child remain with his mother, or that there not be a termination of parental rights. I would also like to just address the presumption with respect to reasonable efforts that was mentioned both in the trial court findings and in the respondent's brief. I don't think that the presumption regarding reasonable efforts under 260C.301 subdivision 1 clause 5 I can be used, because and that is with respect to the child's age and amount of time out of the home, because that applies unless the parent has maintained regular contact with the child and is complying with an out-of-home placement plan. And in this case, I think those two things were present, and therefore I don't think that presumption can be used. And with that, and then the evidence that was provided, I make the argument that there were not reasonable efforts provided to reunify the mother and child. The respondent mentions towing the mother's vehicle back to a city that is not in the area where the child was. And I don't think that that meets the standard of being called a reasonable effort to reunify. I think that the county needed to make a better effort to have a trusting and a working relationship with my client. And with respect to setting up services with professionals or providing other assistance in that regard, I just don't see where that happened. I think all of those efforts were made by my client herself or by outside professionals. And I would argue that that particular element was not satisfied. Thank you. I see my time is up.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Molly French. I'm the assistant Coochaching County attorney. On this case, I also represented the agency at trial. I'm here to respectfully request that this court affirm the trial court's findings that are articulate, that are well thought out, that actively weigh the voluminous amount of evidence that the court had before it at trial, that went through every element that was required of the court to terminate this mother's parental rights under the three statutory provisions. We're asking the court to respectfully affirm those findings and find that termination of parental rights continues to be in this child's best interest. Overall, Your Honor.
On appeal, I have a question for you. The judge terminated on three grounds. If this court finds even one ground is met, which ground do you think is the strongest ground?
Your Honors, in this case, I think clearly mother is palpably unfit. She is a unique individual with unique mental illnesses, unique behavior. Her entire circumstance in life of chaos fits under the palpably unfit standard. But I think the fact that she failed to comply with the case plan in any meaningful way, based on a refusal to demonstrate any insight into any of the reasons why her child was removed, is the strongest reason to terminate her parental rights. But I don't think that this court would have and should have any problem affirming all three grounds. But you are correct, Your Honor. Even if the court is to affirm on one ground, it should still uphold the termination of parental rights.
Ms. French, I want to follow up Judge Riley's question. I thought I saw from perhaps it was the first termination order a reference to a earlier parenting capacity evaluation, but I didn't see it in the record for this case. Am I correct that was not available, or there was no new updated parental capacity evaluation? We often see those with regard to palpable unfitness, it seems, and there was no evidence of that, at least for this termination court.
Right, and that is referenced in Judge Harrington's first order after the first termination of parental rights trial. That was strong evidence then. That wasn't made part of the record specifically as an exhibit during the trial, although Judge Wolf did, clearly state that he was taking judicial notice of the entire record going back to the beginning. So although that's probably not before Your Honors, I think that's something that could be considered. All along, from the very beginning, there were huge concerns that remained as found in the first parental capacity assessment. So correct, but there wasn't an updated one or a second one or a third one going forward with the second TPR trial.
And Ms. French, Rule 5804, I believe that's the new location of the three best interest factors a court must make in any termination. I did not see in the order the court referencing those specific three best interest factors. Do you believe that's fatal to the respondent's position, or if it's in the record, where would you point me to findings the court made that would satisfy those three best interest factors?
I think I would agree with you, Your Honor, that they're not specifically laid out as a reference to 58.04. But when you examine the thorough and articulate findings that Judge Wolf made, I think it's very easy to see where he was applying those best interest factors for the child, especially considering, you know, that in this case, the child had to go through essentially two full permanency timelines to get to a point where we could establish permanency for the child. As the guardian ad litem said many times, the child deserves permanency. This is not a case where, you know, it was doubtful or it was, you know, where the best interest factors were, you know, some were in favor of TPR and some were not. There wasn't anything to weigh. They clearly, all of the factors support TPR, and there wasn't anything besides the fact that the mother clearly loved her child and had a bond with him when he was younger. Nobody doubted that. That was the only thing that weighed in favor of maintaining that relationship. So I don't think it's fatal. You can go through the judge's findings and clearly see how each of those factors is supported by the trial record, by the exhibits, by the long history in the district court that this case presented. And it was the same issues coming up over and over again. So I don't think there's any question that the judge was making the findings required by 5804 that this TPR is in the best interest of this child. When we have a failure to comply with the case plan, as I stated, by mother, in any meaningful way. I don't dispute that she did make some progress towards starting the services that she needed to, but there was no meaningful change or insight or change in behavior to correct the conditions that started this case with the removal of the child.
Well, if I could stop there, Ms. French, and make sure we are all on the same page. Mm-hmm. In terms of the conditions that led to the child's out-of-home placement.
Right.
What were the initial conditions cited?
So if I can clarify with Your Honor, are you referring to the initial conditions back in the 2018 timeframe or the second go-around when the agency removed the child in April of 2000?
Fair question. I think it's more important to look at the second go around, but the statute isn't very clear when it directs courts to consider the conditions leading to the child's out of home placement. So I think it's arguable that you'd have to look back to the first.
Sure. So going back to the very beginning, Ms. Knapp came back into our county after a kind of an erratic road trip with the child, for lack of a better term, living in their vehicle, going through different states. She came back to this county. She's from here. And that's how the agency began working with her on reports from law enforcement of erratic behavior out in public with the child. Homelessness has been a concern going back to the beginning, living in the car. Unsafe behavior, driving with the child, et cetera.
Let's just take a minute, because I think you said homelessness, you said kind of inappropriate or erratic behavior with the child, and then erratic driving with the child. Right. Of those three, by the time that the district court is making its determination, its final determination, had mother corrected the homelessness concern?
She did have an apartment for a long period of time. The homelessness was one of the reasons why the agency asked the court to remove back in April of 2000. So the second removal, or I think technically it was the third, but when we talk about the second half of the case, the homelessness was a big reason why we asked for emergency removal at that time. But mother was able to keep that housing She did eventually work out a lease with the landlord. She was very behind in rent, but I think the evidence showed through trial, one of the reasons she was able to keep that housing was due to the pandemic, due to the inability to be evicted. The issue, though, at trial wasn't necessarily the homelessness, but it was the inappropriateness of the housing, the chaos inside the apartment, the way she kept it completely cluttered and unsafe for the child with all of the oils and the different smells, the allegations of using marijuana inside the apartment, things like that. So that wasn't the main issue at the time of the TPR. It was the continuation of her erratic, unsafe behavior with the child that was the most important issue, not necessarily
the home. Let me just be clear. Are you arguing that the ultimate decision was consistent with the concern about housing back at the beginning, or are you conceding that ultimately the district court focused on something else, more mental health issues than it did right. housing issues?
Right. I think there was still some concern about housing, but as I stated, I would concede that that wasn't the main concern. That wasn't the primary focus of the TPR. If it was just the housing issue, I don't think there would be a TPR. So yeah, Your Honor, I agree with you on that point.
And I know it's a little difficult sometimes because there are frequently multiple concerns.
Right.
But where you have a case, is there some authority that would allow the agency to begin a case with one concern, say housing, but ultimately the district court addresses a separate concern and that that's sufficient as a statutory basis under, what is it, 1B5? Is there some authority that would allow a district court to do that, or is the district court limited to the initial concern? And I understand it's hard sometimes, it's artificial because there are multiple concerns, right. as in this case where you might have had more than one primary concern at the outset was not the primary concern at the end. But if there's any authority that can help us, I'd appreciate that.
And I'm not aware of anything off the top of my head besides the fact that I think when we brought this petition, we have to look at how the circumstances at the time of the second petition and trial were met through the evidence then. This is a weird case because we had essentially two permanency proceedings, and I acknowledge that. But we have to look at what was alleged in the petition and then any changed circumstances at the time of trial regarding mother's ability to parent at that time for the reasonably foreseeable future. So I think that case law about that standard about being able to parent for the reasonably foreseeable future would support the argument that courts understand circumstances could change during the year period that we're dealing with a CHIPS case.
Right. I understand that there are other statutory grounds that if you have one initial concern and then a separate concern at the end, that you might not be able to prevail under 1B5, but you still could potentially prevail under 1B4. I understand that there's that. So I guess my put a fine point on it, you're defending the decision of the district court under 1B5, despite the distinction or the differences between how the case started and the reasons the concerns.
Right. And with all due respect, Your Honor, that's difficult because I don't think there was clearly different circumstances at the inception of the case versus at the time of the TPR, because her mental health issues were the overarching umbrella affecting everything from the homelessness to the criminal activity to the erratic behavior in public to everything. So I look at it as, you know, the umbrella of mental health coming down over all of these separate issues. And through help with the agency, we may have resolved the homelessness to a point, but those concerns were still there. And, you know, when everyone's gone from mother's life, I think that would have easily fallen out as something that was stable in her life. So that's difficult for me to argue because I don't think that's necessarily what happened in this case. And I think when you look at the second permanency petition, what's alleged in that, and what findings the court made, I don't see any big changes in circumstances. So with all due respect, I understand your concern there, but I think when you look at the umbrella of the mental health overarching the entire case going back to 2018, I think that's what we need to focus on versus the individual problems that mother had as a result of that. In response to Ms. Wimmer's argument about reasonable efforts, I struggle to even understand this because what more, as the guardian ad litem said at trial, what more could the agency have done? It was impossible to work with mother due to her mental health. The agency struggled in that regard throughout the entire proceeding, and I don't dispute that, but she can't point to anything else we could have done to try to have a better relationship with mother or to try to offer her a service that was acceptable to her.
Ms. French, throughout the course of these proceedings, mm-hmm. was there something that mother's attorney requested or that mother requested the county do that would fall under the category of reasonable efforts that the county didn't do?
I think besides back off and leave her alone, I can't point to anything. And I'm not aware of really anything in the record that mother asked for that the agency didn't try to accommodate. So, Your Honors, respectfully, the agency asks that you affirm this TPR and affirm that it is in the best interest of this child to give this child the permanency that he deserves after this double long case. We're asking the court to affirm the TPR and allow the child to live in stability going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. French. Ms. Wimmer, do you have rebuttal?
Thank you. I do just have a brief rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you. Just in response to some of the points made by Ms. French, she articulated that she feels that my client failed to comply with the case plan in any meaningful way. And that's said throughout, and I would disagree with that. I think I briefed that in my brief, but I would say if you look at the 10 different requirements in the case plan that SAK did comply with the case plan in a meaningful way. I would disagree that there was any issue at the time of the second TPR trial with respect to housing. I don't know how you could argue that. There's a lease. There was testimony provided about how even a larger apartment could be obtained if the child were returned to my client's care. I think the concerns of the agency were more surrounding societal norms. And I think there was testimony about living in the box and, you know, just a misunderstanding of my client's belief system or different things important to my client there. But I don't know how you could argue that her housing was inappropriate. And then finally, Your Honors, there was a reference to guardian ad litem testimony about the child deserving permanency. And, you know, my client and I agree with that the child does deserve permanency. We just feel that permanency is appropriate with my client, that the child can be safely parented by my client, and that's what's appropriate in this matter. So I would just argue that the evidence is not clear and convincing, that this would be in one of the extraordinary cases where a TPR is warranted, and I would ask that the district court's order be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case was well argued and presented, and we will have our decision out within the statutory timeframe.